be your reality, but it becomes something more dangerous and worrying when their stories start to affect your reality. This happened to me most notably in 2007 when I was going out with Ed Simons from the Chemical Brothers. He's an actual human person too, and he's now training to be a psychiatrist. But in terms of the tabloids, we didn't exist as human beings with rights to privacy and dignity. We were pop stars and therefore fair game. When I started seeing Ed, I was working hard writing my second album, It's Not Me, It's You, and my career was in full swing. Then, not long after Ed and I had got together, the tabloids called my press agent to seek confirmation that I was pregnant. I wasn't. But even though my press agent firmly denied it, the news editor of The Sun, a guy called Chris Farrow, was adamant that his paper was going to run a story saying I was. I was dumbfounded. Why would The Sun think I was pregnant? Even if they'd been going through my bins, they couldn't have found a pregnancy test because I hadn't done one. Maybe someone followed me to the gynecologist. Maybe they knew somehow that I'd had my coil removed at around this time. I'd had it removed not because I wanted to conceive, but because I'd had it in for 5 years, and it was time to give my body a break and use another method of contraception. It didn't really matter why or how The Sun had a pregnancy theory in their heads. Maybe they were just bluffing to get any reaction out of me. What was important from my point of view was that it didn't hit the headlines. My Catholic nan was very ill at the time and she died months later. The idea that a dying woman would have to read something untrue that would upset her gravely seemed unbearable to me, and I had to stop it. I wrote Chris Farrow a measured email. I figured that being polite would help not stir the pot. I told him that my grandmother was very ill and that she wouldn't survive reading something like this in a newspaper. Please don't write the story, I said. Then, a week or so went past and I missed my period. I was, in fact, pregnant and freaked out on many levels. How on earth did The Sun find out that I was pregnant before I did? This is insane, I thought. My paranoia went into overdrive. If The Sun knows I'm pregnant and I don't announce it, then they'll be on the prowl for an abortion story. I was literally traumatized by the Coke Bender front page story a year or so earlier, so I didn't know how I would cope with this. The shock, combined with hormones, and being followed everywhere I went by several men on bikes with cameras, and generally feeling hunted, resulted in me being completely crippled with anxiety. I didn't know what to do. I hadn't meant to get pregnant, and I knew I didn't want to have the baby. But now, I'd have to get the pregnancy terminated in the public eye and under the spotlight of the tabloid press, all the while enduring their hypocritical moralizing. That seemed an appalling prospect. I also worried that Ed, who was a successful guy in his 40s, a good partner, in other words, might think that I'd got pregnant accidentally on purpose as a way to trap him. I also worried, on the other hand, that if I told Ed I didn't want the baby, then that would be akin to declaring our relationship futureless and thus risk him leaving me. And this is me, Lily, we're talking about. I'd do anything not to actively risk a guy leaving me. So, that night, I had to tell Ed that I was pregnant, and I had to pretend to be happy about it. Then I had to tell the world that I was pregnant, and pretend to be happy about it. And then, 3 weeks later, I had to fake a miscarriage. It felt to me like this was the only way to explain my pregnancy and it ending with some kind of dignity. I was 24 years old and 5 weeks pregnant with raging hormones. I felt like I was a bad person because I was demanding huge amounts of attention for announcing my pregnancy to the world early, pretending to be happy about it, and then pretending to be distraught at having had a miscarriage. Ed and I broke up a few months later anyway, not surprisingly, given my dysfunction. The tabloids kept telling me that I was out of control, I was drinking too much and taking too many drugs, and so I began to think, yeah, that's me. I was young. I couldn't talk to anyone about the truth. I felt like I was serving a sentence, and that sentence was, you can't talk to anyone. You can't trust anyone. You're alone. I served that sentence for many years, and I paid highly for my feelings of distrust and paranoia. As I went forward, I tried to paper over feeling isolated in all kinds of ways by attaching myself too quickly to men. How could I be alone if I found a partner? And by paying too much attention to what floated around me, on the surface, how good I looked, or didn't, the clothes I could buy or acquire, the parties I could go to, the success I could earn, the fun I could have, it wasn't all bad, the drink I could consume, and the drugs I could score and take. Instead of cleaning myself up and proving them wrong or just plain ignoring them completely, which I found impossible, I reacted to their constant haranguing by taking lots of drugs. Reader, I scored and took a lot of drugs. Glastonbury. I started taking drugs recreationally when I was 15. My friends and I went to squat parties every weekend to listen to drum and bass and jungle music, and there was quite a lot of ketamine around. We took that because it was cheap. Coke back then was something that older boys gave you if you were young and pretty. We couldn't afford to buy it ourselves, but what we were really after was ecstasy. I discovered the joys of E at Glastonbury. Glastonbury has always been a part of my life, and drugs, for me, have always been a part of Glastonbury. That's why I haven't been there recently. I no longer want to go somewhere for 3 days and take lots of drugs, but I find it difficult to go there and not take drugs. It's a shame. I know people who do go there sober and have a great time, and there are NA meetings at Glastonbury these days, but I'm not there yet. I'm still like, why do it to yourself? For me, being with 500,000 people high on drugs while I'm sober would be an act of masochism. I know my limits. I can't do it. The first time I went to Glastonbury was in 1985. I was 8 weeks old. For us Allens, Glastonbury was more important than Christmas, and certainly it was when more of our family gathered together. But even though it was a family thing, us kids had our own identities at the festival. Because we had our own friends down there within the larger group, and we could go off in our little groups and find the music we wanted to listen to, or the tents we wanted to dance in, or the food that we wanted to eat. And that felt like a rare thing. I think that's why I liked it so much. We could be independent and find what we liked on our own. But there was this big family unit built around the campfire that was always there for us to return to. It wasn't all idyllic. Glastonbury isn't May Day. The grown-ups took drugs, sometimes too many. As I got older, I began to recognise other people's drug-related anxiety. You know how the mood can shift at 4 a.m. when people are off it, when things get sketchy. When things stop being funny and people stop sharing drugs and start going off to the bathroom alone or with just one chosen person and the atmosphere turns sour and aggressive rather than fun and communal. I learned to recognise that moment when I was a child. I think that's why I always stop now when the atmosphere changes. It's a no-go zone for me. I've hammered away at drugs and drink, and as you'll see later, I did hit a rock-bottom point with drink, but until that moment, I was never someone who kept going after a party turns dark. I can recognise it instantly. I'm sure because I witnessed it at Glastonbury with my dad and his mates around the campfire. My reaction is flight. I take myself off quickly, quietly, wherever I am, and either leave or, if the party is at my house, put myself to bed, even if it means taking sleeping pills or downers to get to sleep. But before things turn sour with drugs, taking them can be brilliant. I loved my first ecstasy experience. I was 15, and I did it with Makita and Phoebe. I think we had 20 quid between us, so we scored 3 E's, took one each, and then somehow got separated. It can be frightening to be at a festival alone and high on drugs, especially if it's your first time on ecstasy, but I was okay. One thing my dad had taught me at Glastonbury over the years was the art of the blag, and I managed to blag someone to take me to the drum and bass tent where I knew they'd be dancing. Then I blagged the MC to make an announcement for them to meet me in the middle of the tent. It worked. But then, so much seems to go right at Glastonbury. Over the years, we tried on everything there. Occasionally, we got given backstage passes for certain gigs through Dad's friend, the musician Joe Strummer. But more often than not, we had to talk and wangle our way to the side of the stage if we wanted to watch someone close up and be in on the action. We didn't just blag stuff at Glastonbury as kids and teenagers. We stole it too. We were terrors. We never had any cash there. Even if my dad had money at that point, and it went up and down, he wouldn't give it to us. And certainly not at Glastonbury, where he knew it would have been spent on drugs. So we used to nick it from the grown-ups. We stole other stuff too. If it was a muddy year, we'd go around the jewellery shops and pinch rings and earrings by dropping them onto the mud on our boots and then walking away from the stall. We'd wash them clean and then sell them. You didn't get much for a bit of hippie silver, but you might score a couple of smoothies or a flag or whatever else we were after back then. Dad didn't pay us much attention, but it didn't seem to matter at Glastonbury. He was there. But sometimes things went wrong. In 1998, he had a heart attack at Glastonbury. That was pretty intense. I was 14 and I remember coming back to the campfire to find Joe's wife, Lucinda, waiting for me. She told me that Dad had been taken to the field hospital in an ambulance and that I should go and see him. They've got an A&E section at the festival, and when I got up there I felt reassured, because there was Dad, all propped up, neat and tidy, in a hospital bed, hooked up to various tubes and machines, looking relatively okay. The heart attack was presumably the result of him taking too much cocaine. Next door to Dad was a girl who'd lost it on acid. She came over and knelt down in front of me. "Have you seen Dave?" she said. "No," I replied. I've lost my boyfriend, she went on, a faraway look in her eyes. He's called Dave, but I don't know where he is. Can you help me find him? Okay, I said, what does he look like? She held her fingers up an inch apart. He's this big, she said, squinting her eyes as if measuring him up, with brown hair. I remember thinking, I'm not the adult in this situation, but I'm going to assume that role and try and reassure this girl. Dave is going to turn up, I told her. He just might be a bit bigger than you're expecting. Dad was discharged from the hospital tent the next day. He got taken back to our campsite and tucked up in bed in one of the caravans there. I went to check on him and found him with a rolled-up banknote in his hand and a book on his lap, about to snort a line of cocaine from it. I was furious. You've just had a heart attack from taking too much cocaine, and now you're taking cocaine, I shouted. He didn't care. He took the coke anyway. Glastonbury stopped being a family thing after Joe died in 2002. Dad still went after that, but it was different, and I started to go with Makita and Phoebe instead of Dad, and when I was with Lester, I went with him. After Joe died, the Evises carved out a section of the site and called it Strummerville, and every year we were given a special spot there. That's what made performing at Glastonbury even more special. I have this real connection to the place, so playing there was this insanely amazing thing for me. I did my first gig at Glastonbury in 2006. I was on the pyramid stage. Being given that stage felt like I'd gone straight to the top. It felt magic. It felt amazing. I'd spent years blagging at Glastonbury after all, and it had always been a big achievement just to wangle a backstage wristband, and so, at 22 years old, to get given a block of 50 passes to hand out myself, because this time I am the band, felt fucking nuts. One of the things about playing a festival is that there is so much else going on. Some people want to see you play, but they haven't made it over to your stage yet. When you start playing, you see people rushing over. What feels like an empty field suddenly starts filling up from all four corners, and that's an amazing thing to watch, and it makes you feel great. Sometimes, though, the field doesn't fill up at all. At Glastonbury, the field has always filled up for me. But there have been festivals that I've done where it hasn't, and that's been awful. Performers call it the fear of the festival, because you've got to win people over. Even the people right up close to the stage in the front rows, especially those people, in fact, chances are they've come to see whoever is headlining the festival, not you, and they're just waiting out your set to keep their hard-won spot. If you can win those people over and gather a festival crowd together, you feel like you can do pretty much anything. Sometimes, failing to connect, even if it's with just one person, can make a difference to a gig and make you feel like you've done a dud show. In 2006, when I played the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury, I also did an impromptu show on the Friday night to launch the Park Stage. It was the first time Emily Evis had her own section of the festival to plan and run. Emily asked me to play the Park at the last minute to replace the singer MIA, who had cancelled on Emily with only hours to go. It wasn't a good experience, mainly because there was a girl at the front who was clearly livid that MIA was not going to appear. I can still see her face now, and her look of outrage when she saw it was me up on stage instead of MIA. She shouted abuse directly at me the whole way through the gig. The Park Stage is relatively small, and you feel close to the audience, which is a good thing, but it meant that the girl's reaction and anger threw me. I understood what she was saying and I agreed with her. I didn't think I was as cool as MIA either. Most of the time, for all my bluster, I didn't think I was cool at all. That's why I got so defensive when I was sagged off in public. Of course I should have laughed it all off, and these days I do. But back when I was in the thick of all the fame and confusion and felt at home only really when I had a bundle of dramas under my arm, I found it impossible not to take it all too seriously. Celebrity. Gordon Ramsay. What do you think of Lily Allen? Chick with a dick? Cheryl Cole. Nods, laughs, nods again. Oh my fucking god. Cheryl Cole basically called me a chick with a dick on national fucking television. When Smile was released as a single, one of the B-sides was a song called Cheryl Tweedy. It's a jaunty little number about my own self-loathing. The first verse goes, I wish I had qualities like sympathy, fidelity, sobriety, sincerity, humility, instead I got lunacy. The chorus goes like this, I wish my life was a little less seedy, why am I always so greedy, I wish I looked just like Cheryl Tweedy. Cheryl Cole, née Tweedy, was still a pop star in the fantastically popular band Girls Aloud back then. She was petite and perfectly formed, a dinky, perfect prop princess who always looked great. Meanwhile, I often felt like a mess. She talked about my song in an interview. She said she was kind of honoured by it, but managed to be a bit dismissive about it at the same time. I wasn't having that. I responded by writing on my MySpace blog. Cheryl, I don't really want to look like you. I was being ironic. Nobody really wants to look like you. They just think they do. A few months later, in May 2007, Cheryl and her bandmate Kimberly Walsh appeared on a Gordon Ramsay TV show called The F Word. The format of the show entailed famous people eating in a mocked-up restaurant while Ramsay went round the tables in his chef's whites, telling them off for not liking his food enough and gossiping about other celebs. What do you think of Lily Allen? Ramsay asked Cheryl after discovering that she hadn't eaten her foie gras. Chick with a dick? He asked, egging her on. She laughed when he said that. It clearly tickled her. Chick with a dick? She responded, nodding her head and laughing some more. That's when things turned sour. Cheryl, I wrote on my blog, if you're reading this, I may not be as pretty as you, but at least I write and sing my own songs without the aid of autotune. I must say, taking your clothes off, doing sexy dancing and marrying a rich footballer must be very gratifying for you. Your mother must be so proud, stupid bitch. Imagine writing that. It was such a horrible thing to say. Of course Cheryl's mum was proud of her. Why wouldn't she be? It was ridiculous. I bitched at Cheryl because she insulted me after I provoked her. You see how it can go, this playground game. The crazy part was that we then had this feud, as if the hatred between us was a real thing. We didn't know each other. When all this happened, I'd never met Cheryl Cole. I did resent Girls Aloud's success back then, though. There was me, in the left corner, all self-proclaimed feminism, defiant in my prom dresses and trainers, proud of writing my own songs and speaking my own mind. And in the right corner, as I saw it, were Girls Aloud and their ilk, colluding with the oppressors and perpetuating what we were all up against by wearing skimpy clothes and singing songs written by other people. I was the liberated one, okay? I was righteous, and I was calling it out. What a joke. Now I realise it's all a lot more complicated. Now mostly I think, why judge people like that? And anyway, me, liberated back then, hardly. I wore prom dresses because I hated my legs and I wanted to cover them up. Liberated. I was jealous. I was frustrated. I was struggling with my own issues around sexuality. I'd never even had an orgasm. And then here were these gorgeous girls, my peers, colleagues, so to speak, and co-workers, taking their clothes off with wild abandon and being loved and rewarded for it. I couldn't take it. Sorry, Cheryl. I was angry because I hadn't come yet. I think Cheryl Cole took what I said to heart. I assumed she'd come back at me and that our fight would continue and that everyone in the entire country read The Sun would be following our feud. That's how famous I felt in 2007. When you're famous, you get asked to do things you're not qualified for. For example, I'd never had ambitions to act, but when I was famous, I'd be sent scripts to read and parts to consider. I was asked to take the lead role in Neil LaBute's stage play Fat Pig, for example. How could I do that when I've never acted and had zero training? It must drive proper actors mad. Mostly, I just turn those kind of things down, but then there are things you do because they are on the fringes of your industry. Television presenting, for example. Strictly speaking, then, I knew what I was doing, and I was asked to present the GQ Awards in September 2008. I'd done plenty of TV by then, and I knew how to keep my shit together. But boy, it's a long evening to get through. That year, GQ had teamed up with Elton John's AIDS Foundation for the awards. Elton would host the evening. GQ would benefit from the publicity he generated, and money would be raised for the foundation. Basically, at least while collectively wanking off, cash was being raised for a good cause. Elton asked me if I'd like to co-host the evening with him. I said I'd be delighted. Elton and I knew each other pretty well back then. His company, Rocket, was managing me. We were used to ribbing each other. I drank throughout the ceremony. It was a GQ party with a lot of free champagne. Drinking a lot is what everyone does. I got a bit slurry, a bit messy. I was high. Everyone knew. No one cared. Least of all Elton. Now we reach a very special point in the evening, I said, reading from the auto cue, when we came to introduce one of the final awards. What? Elton ad-libbed. Are you going to have another drink? Fuck off, Elton, I said, and I meant it. I'm 40 years younger than you. I've got my whole life ahead of me. Not one to be outdone, Elton turned to me and said, I can still snort you under the table. He enunciated each word with crisp precision. I don't know what you're talking about, I said. Even drunk, I knew not to kick this gambit around. The room was filled with journalists. We were being filmed. We don't usually do this, I started, trying to get back on course. Elton began to interrupt me again. Fuck off, Elton, actually, I spoke loudly over him. Seriously? All right, he said, suddenly defensive, and we went back to script. It was funny. The audience laughed. We were taking the piss out of each other. It was no big deal. The next day, it was reported that we'd fallen out spectacularly in a public catfight, which marked the opening chapter of a feud. We came to blows, the tabloid said, embarking on a scathing war of words. It was obviously all my fault. I had appeared drunk and dishevelled, and my behaviour had been disgraceful. What a load of bollocks. Even Elton had to wade in and comment on the press reaction. That was just such nonsense, he said in an interview. We had a great time. I love Lily. She was feeling no pain. I was feeling no pain. I was sober. She wasn't, but it doesn't matter. We certainly didn't have a fallout on stage. It's disconcerting when what is reported outside the bubble is different to what has gone on inside it. I got drunk at an awards party and bantered on stage with my co-host. We were photographed together with our arms around each other. No, the papers said. You were catfighting, drunk in disgrace, and now you're feuding with Sir Elton John. That's the sort of thing that happens inside the fame bubble, and it's freak show hall of mirrors, and almost as soon as I was inside it, I knew I wanted out. I knew I wanted a real life with babies and a home and a life partner, and more, I realised I wanted it soon. I'd already met Sam, the man I would marry, and a month later I would clean myself up and move in with him. He, I thought, would help provide me with my escape route. It turned out to be easier than that. It turned out that once I had stopped drinking and drugging and I had a clear head, all I had to do was step away from the fame bubble, and off it floated, without me. It turned out that my second album title was just as prescient as I'd hoped. It's not me, fame, you fucker. It turns out it's you. Work, part two. You'd think that I might have felt self-conscious or under pressure when it came to making my second album. Making a follow-up album is famously a nightmare for a lot of recording artists if they've had a successful debut. They feel paralysed by self-doubt or crippled by high expectations. They've most likely been living in the fame bubble too, if their first album was a success. It's hard to write about success and fame in a song without sounding like a dick, and quite often that's the only material you've got. Being famous and riding the wave is all you've been doing. Sure, there are moments of glamour, the parties and booze, and you can get laid any time. Drugs are plentiful, flowers arrive frequently, money slops about, freebies are dispatched, and you're welcomed into any party. Some people revel in all that. Others despise it. Most people jog along somewhere in the middle, trying to find a way to manipulate it so that they can enjoy both success and some kind of private and meaningful life. But however you feel towards it all, success and fame, it's not necessarily all that interesting in terms of creative material. I remember people talking to me and laughing about it. You did it once, they'd say, about finding success with my first album. Good luck following it up. Yeah, thanks, I would think. How hilarious. Wouldn't it be funny if I lost it all? That didn't happen. My second record came easily. I'd been on the road for a year and a half before I got into the studio, and the song seemed to come out all at once. I'm not sure that young artists today suffer from second album syndrome in the same way as past generations. Now that streaming has replaced traditional record buying and the album has lost its totemic significance, I was on the cusp of that change. And in fact, the experience of fame did prove a rich seam to mine. The dislocation between my inner and outer life and the difference between how I felt and how I was portrayed in the press seemed so gaping that it warranted exploring. It was, for me, interesting and relevant material. My first album, All Right Still, had been something of a patchwork made up of a song here and a song there. I didn't want my second album to be like that. I wanted it to feel more streamlined, like one complete story. I also knew that the person I wanted to work with it on was Greg, and him alone. We already had a working shorthand, and he understood my references. I liked him too. He's not show busy. I felt comfortable writing with him and not self-conscious when working things out. We started writing It's Not Me in a rented cottage in Moreton and Marsh in Gloucestershire in 2007. I wanted to get away from London, and I'd heard about these residential studios in the country that bands sometimes rent. Private, mini Babington-type places with a recording suite next to the bar and a hot tub in the vegetable garden. I thought a stint somewhere like that would be fun and productive, but the label was like, fuck off, we're not paying that much money for you to work. So I asked for a tiny cottage instead. It had a living room with a weird wall down the middle. I'd sit on one side and write on the sofa, and Greg would be on the other side with his computer set up on the dinner table. We'd cross sides to play each other stuff. I'd sing riffs and verses and come up with a top line, the melody that drives the song, or I'd listen to the chords that he was working on and I'd be like, yep, that's good, and the words would follow. We had to have the curtains drawn all the time because a bunch of kids cottoned onto us being there, and they'd listen in, tapping away in time and trying to learn the lyrics I was banging out. You could hear them singing along on some of the early demos, but other than the kids, there weren't many distractions. We didn't have Wi-Fi, and I didn't miss it. By the end of week one, we'd written three songs. Go Back to the Start, The Fear, and Who'd Have Known. When I wrote Who'd Have Known, I thought, okay, this one's a goer. What a great hook. I'd never usually think that about my music. It was the same with The Fear, which became my first hit from my second album. I had no idea that I'd written what would become a seminal song for me. I write to tell a story and express myself. My lyrics are lodged in particular experiences and places rather than being deliberate anthems. I write songs, not hits. If the song is good, people would connect with it. You don't have to trick them into it. Greg used to say that I write best when I'm upset, hungover, sleep-deprived, or driving. He's right. It's because half my brain is occupied with something else and hasn't got the energy to be critical or hamper the creative bit. Generally, if something comes quickly and naturally to me, then it tends to be good. It may then go through a hugely complex process and become a task to finish and produce, but if it comes quickly at the start, that's generally a sign that I'm onto something. And that's what happened with Who'd Have Known. Greg played a chord and my brain followed that chord with the chorus. It was effortless. We played it to Parlophone when they came to visit us at the end of week one to see how we were doing. Yeah, they said, great song. Just one problem. It's number one already. I'd unknowingly cribbed Take That Song, Shine. I must have heard it in the radio, in the supermarket, or out in the world of Morton and Marsh, and it had earwormed its way into my head and then out again as the chorus of my song. There's a computer program now that can tell you if the song you've written is a rip-off of someone else's, and how much you should change to make it just different enough that you don't have to pay to use someone else's work. I don't like doing that. If a song sounds good, it sounds good. Don't change it for the sake of saving money, but instead pay the money to whoever wrote the original music you've riffed. I ran into the Take That guys back in London once I'd finished the album and I told them about Who'd Have Known. I just need to tell you that I've got a song on my new record that I've stolen from you, I said. That's funny, they said. You bet, they laughed. They got a huge chunk of money from my song. Most of the publishing income from that song goes to them. That's the way it goes. They wrote the hook, they get the money. I won 3 Ivor Novello Awards for It's Not Me, It's You in 2010. These are the only awards that mean anything to me. The Ivors aren't that well known outside the music business because they aren't televised, but they're the ones that really count in the industry. They're awarded for excellence in songwriting, and the panel is made up of songwriters rather than record label heads or execs. 4 years later, in 2014, I was on the judging panel myself, so I know how seriously it's taken. Everyone on the panel, a group of peers, listens to the music over and over again, then endlessly discusses each song and argues about lyrics and chord progressions. I'm proud of those awards. The Fear won 2, one for Best Song Musically and Lyrically, the other for Most Performed Song. That year, I also won the award for Best Songwriter. The Fear is about feeling lost in a lot of ways, and after winning the award, I felt found, I felt heard, I felt like my work had landed somewhere proper and with weight. Forget about that with other awards, at least in the music industry. Sure, they enhance your commercial currency, and that's something, but they are about money, not merit. I did like getting the GQ Award, Woman of the Year, even though I knew, as I was collecting it, what an absurdity it was. I liked everyone going, yes, clap clap, you are the best woman, and me smiling in response and trotting up to collect it and thinking, you're right, I am a woman, and I am very good at being a woman. You might as well enjoy that bit of theatre, even though you know it's all nonsense, and you wouldn't have been given the award if you hadn't agreed to pose topless for their cover. The Brit Awards aren't like that. They aren't fun in the same way at all. They are run by the parasitic side of the business, the money men, and they feel like a gigantic ego fest. They stink of wastefulness. It's like, look at all the money we're spending to help already established acts sell even more records. I'm not blameless in it. I've contributed to the charade of it all. I opened the show in 2010. I was pleased to be asked. It's a straight-up ego boost, but mostly it made me feel anxious and I hated my performance. I didn't have a great relationship with the Brits anyway, because I'd felt slighted by them in 2007 when I was nominated for 5 awards with All Right Still, but won not one. That was the year Amy Winehouse won everything. I remember seeing her perform with Mark Ronson that year and thinking, that's it then, it's the Amy show, she's going to scoop it all up, and she deserved to win everything too. I'm a huge fan of Amy's work, and I liked her too, though I never knew her well. What I didn't like was the way that the industry pitted us against each other. In the press it was all, here's Amy, this talented trouble genius, whereas Lily is quite talented but not up there with Amy. Why did we have to be compared like that? There were 55 other people in the charts, so why were they taking these two people who were quite different musically and comparing them just because they were both women? Still, in 2010 I agreed to perform. To make it extra hard to say no, they dangle hints that you're going to win something, so you'd better play ball. I remember being told that I was going to get Best Female Solo Artist. When I heard that, I thought, fuck, I don't want to be Best Female. That's fine for GQ magazine, but a music award should be about my work, and I wanted Best Album. Florence and the Machine won it, and good for her. But her being a good recipient didn't make me want it less. I sang The Fear, which is doubly ironic, given that the song was written as a reaction against the very values that the Brits embody. There I was, singing a satirical song about fame and money on a platform that is all about celebrating fame and money, and boy, for me to sing it, they certainly spent money. You don't get to decide, or at least I didn't, how my set would go. They tell you their vision for your performance. You're going to come out on a rocket, Lil, and the stage is going to be full of female dancers with prams, and then loads more dancers, guys this time, are going to come dangling down from the ceiling, not wearing trousers and looking like pricks in pink helmets. Yeah, Lil? You feeling it? What I remember was feeling uncomfortable. Really? I said. We have to have all of that? I thought, what the fuck is this all about? Aren't us women performers enough? Why do we need to have all this other shit going on behind us? Then they tell you it's going to be great, and they've got the amazing choreographer Bianca Lee to stage it, and she is amazing, and you think, still though, I don't like it. I feel uncomfortable. Then you think, there is so much I do for work that I'm not comfortable with, and this isn't up there with the worst shit, so fine, I won't fight this battle. Put me on the fucking rocket. Send in the clowns. The point is, those awards are hollow. They're about what deals and negotiations are going on between the labels. It's their show. That's why you saw Skepta and Stormzy being nominated in 2017, but neither one winning a single prize. What do you mean they didn't win? Which other artist has had a bigger impact on the music industry over the last few years? No one. But that would be a waste of a prize or two as far as the big companies are concerned, because both those guys are independent rather than signed to any major record label. Still, at least they don't have to take half their clothes off to perform on those kinds of shows. I don't think Stormzy has ever had to deal with a comment about his arse. I had proved myself as a songwriter with It's Not Me, It's You, and yet I was still expected to look as hot as possible. I know. I went along with it. I took my clothes off for photo shoots, and I often performed on stage in little more than my underwear. I felt sexy with this record. I was slim and in shape, and I felt like I'd begun to take possession of my own sexuality. I emphasized the word begun. Me and sex? That's a whole other chapter. Sex, Part 1. The second single to be rolled out for my second album was It's Not Fair. It's a song about shitty sex, and I think it rang true for a lot of people. Everyone thought I'd written it about the art dealer, Jay Jopling, who I was seeing around that time. And it would make a better story if it had been about him. But it's not. It isn't about any one guy. It's about a whole load of them. Hell, I wish shitty sex had been about a one-off experience. I'd never had an orgasm when I wrote that song. Not a single one. Not with someone else and not by myself. I didn't masturbate when I was young, or in my teens, or even for most of my 20s. It's hard for me to unravel why. Certainly, pleasing myself in any way was never high on my list of priorities, and so the idea of actively exploring a zone that was apparently dedicated to pleasure felt impossible. I didn't feel like I'd served it. If you spent most of your childhood feeling invisible, then it feels odd to start paying too much attention to yourself when you're on your own. It feels foreign and not right, because it's the opposite of what you're used to. Once I started having sex, I didn't come either, and so I thought I was just someone who couldn't, who didn't. Not coming when it comes to sex with a guy is common, especially for young women who are inclined to be undemanding in bed. It seems too bold an ask for many of us, and for some reason, too many of us collectively retreat into passivity. Instead of exploring what makes us come, good oral sex being the surest route, we just fake it. I'd spent years faking orgasms by the time I wrote It's Not Fair. The song was about feeling like a vessel for male pleasure. I was with Jay for 3 or 4 months at the beginning of 2009, just as It's Not Me, It's You was being released. It was a fling. He was someone I knew through my dad's friend, Damien Hirst. Jay was on one side of Damien's life, my dad on the other. Dad hated Jay. He thought he was a posh wanker. That's possibly one reason why I fancied him. I knew it would piss off my dad. And he was an older guy that I liked. I liked that he took me to parties, and in January he sent a private jet to fly me to St. Bart's to stay with him on the yacht that he'd rented. I liked, or I thought I liked, that he was rich, posh, secure, charming, and that he liked buying me expensive presents. I thought that was akin to him taking care of me. There were paparazzi photos of us together taken on that yacht that were published in the tabloids. That's how my dad found out that I was seeing someone from his world. He texted Jay when he saw the photographs. I knew because I saw Jay get the text. His face turned white when he read it. "You wait, Jay," my dad said. "You wait till Angelica is 16. Angelica is Jay's daughter. She was 11 years old in 2009. Jay's ex-wife, Sam Taylor Johnson, also texted him when she saw the photos. "What are you doing going out with that dwarf?" she wrote. Our relationship fizzled out. I can't remember exactly how it ended. I don't think the newspaper articles and my dad's text and Sam calling me a dwarf helped. I am very short, but it was mean of him to show me her text. I remember thinking, I don't need to hear that your ex-wife called me a dwarf, thank you very much. I was still dating Jay when I landed a contract with Chanel to model for one of their campaigns. I rang him as soon as I got the news. It was massively exciting for me. I thought he'd be excited too. "I hope you're getting enough money for it," he said dryly, immediately deflating me. "But look," codependent me wanted to shout. "Never mind the money. It means they think I'm beautiful. They think I'm pretty, see? Don't you think I'm pretty too? Don't you love me? Don't you want to marry me now? Can't you be the one I hitch my wagon to? Because I know we're massively unsuited, but you're here next to me, and so you'll do. You can be him. You can be the one to look after me." That's what I did with all the guys I dated. I attached myself to them as firmly as I could and as stickily as they'd allow. I convinced myself that they were right for me and we were meant to be together, even if really we would have been better off as friends. Indeed, I've stayed friends with all of my ex-boyfriends, which might prove my point. I was confused at the beginning of my sexual life about my own desire for other people. Often, if a guy fancied me, that was enough for both of us. My self-worth was low, and so being fancied, which I translated as being wanted and thus loved, felt intoxicating enough to agree to sex. Of course, I now know that a guy wanting to fuck you is not the same as him wanting you. Quite often, he'll fuck you even if he doesn't want you, just because he can. He'll fuck you if he fancies you, and he'll fuck you if he doesn't. In fact, he'll fuck you while he's in the process of rejecting you. A guy will sometimes beg to fuck you, not because he wants to fuck you that badly, but because knocking down the wall that you've put up is a turn-on for him. Or maybe it's not the act of the conquest that turns him on, but in a twisted version of S&M, he likes feeling humiliated by your attempts at rejecting him. Or maybe he likes witnessing your humiliation. Who fucking knows? Guys fuck women for all kinds of reasons, which sometimes include a genuine desire for intimacy and to connect on whatever level, but often don't. That's why the only important thing is to know what you want as a woman and a human and a sexual person. You may not get it, and you may be overridden, but knowing what you want and making sure you try to assert that means that at least you start from a place of power and strength. I had none of that power when I first started having sex. I didn't have it for many years. I didn't claim it or even really know about it. Many women don't. Instead, I gave myself away. I gave myself away, but men also took from me. They helped themselves to me. Yes, I'm talking about fucking me. When they knew or should have known, they were old and experienced enough, I was too young and too naive and too pliant to say no. I know a great many women will know exactly what I'm talking about. It happens all the time. And it's not rape, and it's not quite assault, but it's not right, and it shouldn't happen. I lost my virginity to a guy called Fernando. I met him in Brazil on holiday with Dad and Alfie when I was 14. There was a teen bar at the hotel where we were staying, and that's where we met. Fernando was 20, and I was flattered that he fancied me, so off I went, trailing after him when he suggested going back to his room. I can't remember the sex. Mostly, I remember waking up late the next morning in Fernando's room and feeling panicked. Shit, I thought. Dad is going to wonder where I am. Dad had wondered. Not only was I missing, but I'd been wearing a blue top the previous night when I disappeared, and a similar one had been found on the beach earlier that morning. Boats were scouring the sea, a search party had been called, the police had arrived. I'd caused a commotion. Dad was furious. Second time I had sex was no more nurturing. I'd been watching my dad play a celebrity charity football game with a television star. After the match, the TV star left his football gear in my dad's car, and I was dispatched to his hotel to return it. We arranged to meet in the bar there. He bought me a couple of drinks and then took me up to his room and had sex with me. I was 14. He was 19. But to me, he seemed like someone from a different generation. Afterwards, I felt funny about it. I knew what had happened wasn't right, and so I told a friend of my dad's about it, and he told my dad. I think I wanted my dad to know. I wanted him to make things better. In my teenage head, I wanted Dad to explode with protective anger and to find the TV guy and beat him up. Instead, my dad turned it into a shtick with his friends. They made up elaborate schemes to blackmail the guy, and they rehearsed how they'd call him up and put the shits up him. They may even have gone as far as to make the phone call. I don't know. I just know that my dad turned me having sex with this guy I hardly knew into a joke between him and his mates, and that didn't make me feel good. It wasn't a coincidence that my first sexual partners were older than me. 5 years isn't much when you're both adults, but when one of you is a young teenager and the other has hit 20-ish years old, it's a big difference. A lot of experience, especially in terms of sex, gets packed into those late teen years. I was infatuated with older men because I felt that if I could prove to somebody older that I could be mature too, then I was grown up myself. I didn't feel comfortable being a child, as I may have mentioned 800 times. Sleeping with older men was a way of trying to kickstart the next chapter of my life. I'm sure, too, that any shrink in the land would explain it as me trying to find a father figure, because my own had always absented himself from that role. I didn't flirt with the boys I hung out with, who were mostly older than me, too. I was used to relentless lad behaviour from spending time with my dad and his mates when he took me to the football on a Saturday or to hang out at Groucho's until 5 in the morning, so I knew how to shoot the shit with the guys, but sex was different. I also thought that an older guy would be better equipped to show me what the whole sex thing was about, because I found it so mysterious myself. I wasn't sexualized as a young person. My sister was always the sexy one when we were growing up. I wasn't like her. She looked older than her years. I looked younger. She was tall. I was short. She looked sophisticated. I didn't. So I didn't try and compete with her, especially when it came to the opposite sex. She could have sex with anyone she wanted, but when she did, it didn't seem to empower her. To me, it looked like the guys used her for sex. I didn't want that to happen to me, and so I shied away from exploring it actively, either by myself or with boys close to my own age. And yet, of course, the same thing happened to me. Sex didn't empower me for years. Those older men I had sex with at the beginning had no interest in helping me explore or discover sex. They didn't give a shit about me or any of that. That's why I wish I had started out exploring sex with a peer rather than it being something done to me. I wish, too, that I had insisted on better sex earlier on in my life, or at least fairer sex, or funnier sex, more fun sex, or sexier sex. But I didn't. Not enough of us do. The relationship I'm in now is the first time, I think, ever where sex has been an important factor. That's telling right there. I wasn't friends with Dan before I got together with him. I met him at Notting Hill Carnival in August 2015 when I went up to him and asked him if he had a rizza. I fancied him. I can do better than that, he said, and opened up a glasses case that was full of pre-rolled joints. I'm in my 30s now and I have regular orgasms. I make sure of that. If I get back from working in the studio and I've got 20 minutes before I have to pick up the kids from school, I think, brilliant, I can get the dinner on and I've still got time for a quick wank. Now I know what happens when I come, but for years, when I was faking orgasms all the time, I didn't even know what my real coming noise was. I just did that ahhing noise that you see on TV and in films. The guys I was with seemed to buy it. Did you come? They'd ask. Oh yeah, I'd say. Oh yeah, baby, I came. Still, even though I wasn't coming in my 20s, I was having plenty of sex. It wasn't all bad. Some of it, when I was with Lester, and then Seb, and then Ed, was loving and intimate, if not orgasmic. Other times, when I was single and out and about, it could be exciting. If I didn't get off at the end of sex, the beginning bit, the chase, the seduction, I found intoxicating. In 2004, when I was 19, I had a crush on Mike Skinner from the streets. Most teenagers, when they have a crush on a singer or a movie star, stick posters on their walls. Some wait around outside hotels or queue for hours to get close to the stage at concerts. If you're really determined, you might try and become a groupie, but you need to be gorgeous and exotic with sex tricks up your sleeve to get that gig and super tough to survive it. I wasn't going to settle for a homemade bedroom shrine or going to a few gigs, but I also knew that in a festival packed with girls in England, Mike Skinner from the streets would never notice me. But in Japan? Maybe in Japan, I thought, where Skinner won't know anyone. Maybe there he might see me in my Reebok classics. The Fuji Rock Festival takes place every year in Naiba, a ski resort 120 miles from Tokyo, on the last weekend of July. If you're doing the international festival circuit, it's the next big one after Glastonbury. I knew the guy who ran the festival through his brother Gaz, whose blues night in Soho I'd been going to for years, and so I got myself a job driving a golf buggy around the festival, ferrying performers between tents, VIP areas, and the stage. I didn't want the job just because Mike Skinner was playing at the festival. I knew it would be a blast, whatever happened. But that was definitely a bonus. Plus, there was no guarantee that I'd get to drive Mike Skinner in my buggy anyway. I had to be more Machiavellian than that. And so, I found out what flight he and his band were on to Japan, and I booked myself on the same one. This meant that we were also on the same long shuttle bus journey from Tokyo up into the mountains of Naiba. You can see my plan. It worked too. Almost too well. All my wishes came true and I ended up in bed with Mike Skinner from the street at the Fuji Rock Festival. We didn't actually have sex, but we had a great time and I fell in love with him. That's what I thought, at least. And if you believe you're in love, even when it's based on fantasy, it feels vital and urgent to be with that person. But once we got back to England, Mike Skinner didn't want to be with me at all. I was like, what's going on? And he was like, stop calling me because otherwise my girlfriend is going to find out. It was horrible. 3 years later, in 2007, we met again when we were both playing at the Big Day Out Festival in Australia. I was due on stage after him. As far as he was concerned, I was just some girl that he'd boned at a festival in Japan, but I wasn't some girl any longer. I was bigger and better than him, and I could tell him to get off the stage because it was my turn now. I could have taken the high road, behaved well, and been polite, but I couldn't manage it. I got hammered on stage drinking Jägermeister, and after the show, when Mike Skinner's manager was rude to me, instead of rising above it, I lost it. I kicked in doors, threw stuff, screamed, cried, and had to be dragged away by the guys from Kasabian who were playing on the same festival. I guess something was going on that got played out. And truthfully, I've never been better than Mike Skinner. I was bigger than him at that moment back in 2007, and I was doing better than him commercially and financially, but artistically and as a songwriter, him, he's better. About 18 months after the fight in Australia, I ended up hiring Skinner's band. The guys who had been The Streets played on my second album and toured with me. So when I returned to the Fuji Rock Festival in July 2009, I was no longer the girl trying to get with the band. I was the girl and they were my band. By then, things had become debauched. Festival season by 2009 was for me a haze of drugs and alcohol. I was on the road, drinking my way from gig to gig. So, when I, along with my band and crew, was on the way to Japan, the drinking began in Virgin's upper-class lounge at Heathrow. That's where we were when Liam Gallagher and his side of the Oasis crew showed up. Oasis was still together in 2009, but Liam and Noel travelled separately to venues however far away, and each had their own crew. We all got hammered together in the bar. We got more hammered on the plane. At some point, Liam and I found ourselves together in the toilet doing something that we shouldn't have been doing, and it wasn't drugs. Then we were in a lie-down bed together. When we landed in Tokyo, Liam said in his distinctive nasal twang, "What you doing now? Why don't you come back to our hotel?" He and his crew were staying at the Lost in Translation Hotel in Tokyo, the Park Hyatt, whereas we were in a shithole, so I was like, yeah, okay, fine. It wasn't until the next day when he said something like, "No one can hear about this because of Nick," that I clocked he was married. I knew Noel was married, and I knew Liam had been married to Patsy Kensit. That was partly why I fancied him. I'd grown up as an Oasis fan. I was 12 when he and Patsy Kensit were on the cover of Vanity Fair as the coolest couple in the world, and that's who Liam was to me even 12 years later, that same cool dude. Obviously, I shagged him. I didn't think of Nicole Appleton, even though I must have vaguely known that Liam was with her. When he reminded me about her existence, I was horrified. Even though I wasn't the one who was married or who had cheated, it also meant I couldn't tell anyone about what had happened, because surely part of the point of shagging Liam Gallagher is being able to tell your friends about it. It's so depressing, isn't it? Why do we validate ourselves with our sexual conquests? Men do it all the time and we resent them for it, but actually we're just as bad. So, I didn't tell anyone, except a couple of close friends, one of whom was good friends with Jamie Winston, who in turn was good friends with Melanie Blatt from All Saints. One way or another, Nicole Appleton had heard about what had gone down at Fuji Rock Festival that summer. 6 months later, I was in my car with my driver when the phone rang. I didn't recognise the number, but I did know the voice. It was Liam. He sounded awful, like he'd been up all night. "Lil," he said, "I just need you to get on the phone. I've got Nick here, right? One of your mates is, like, trying to do a wind-up or something. She said that you and me had it off or whatever, and I just need you to speak to Nick and say that it's all bollocks." "Oh, Liam. Yes, sure, it's all bollocks. Let's say it's all bollocks. Of course, I'll tell Nicole that it's all bollocks, if that's what you want. And not think about it too much, or even at all, and then maybe it will go away and not disrupt what really matters, the people we love and rely on, the people we trust, who deserve to be able to trust us in return. It's bollocks, Liam. Of course it is. Except when suddenly it isn't. Because if nothing inside the bubble matters, then does anything? Sure, it was only a shag and on tour at that, but the problem is, as I discovered only too well, if you keep denying and belittling your own experiences, intimate ones at that, then everything becomes diminished. It's insidious. Your whole value system shifts. Your sense of integrity gets blurry. I didn't just begin to devalue intimacy as I became famous. I got careless with other things too. My health, for example. My well-being. Money. Money. I don't know how much money I've made. Honestly. No one tells you, and I've never asked. Once Smile came out, I knew I could spend money, and that's what I did. God, that was great. No doubts there. But no one told me about keeping checks and balances. No one told me how it actually works when you sign a record contract with a record company and then make a record that may succeed or may well not. Of course, I knew how much I was paid as an advance for my first album because I received a check for 25 grand. That was in 2005, when Parlophone signed me for a 5-album deal. What this means is that I'm locked into this deal at whatever they agreed to pay me in 2005 for years and years and years. It's been 12 years so far and I'm on album 4. Of course, back then I was grateful to be signed up by anyone. And it was Parlophone who was taking a risk. They might not have got that 25 grand back, or their expenses, if Smile had sunk without a trace. Plus, as you make each album, you do get to renegotiate your advance depending on the sales of each previous record, but only, crucially to a certain extent, only within the terms set by the record company when they offered you that deal back on day one. Many bands and artists get locked into hugely unfavourable and constricting deals, and many, including Coldplay, Radiohead, George Michael and Prince, have paid lawyers hundreds of thousands of pounds to try and get them released from these deals. This is not because they want to deprive the record company of a fair share of the pie, but because they discover that actually the pie isn't being shared fairly at all, and they want to work under their own terms. The point is, at the beginning of your career, the record company holds all the cards. You just want in. No one explains the rules, and certainly I, like many of my peers, didn't ask enough questions or scrutinise what I was being offered closely enough. Now, of course, some of the discrepancies are more transparent. The huge pay gap between men and women, for example, but back then it wouldn't have occurred to me to ask questions about my male peers or about my own potential worth. Not only did I immediately accept what I was offered, when it came to money I didn't even think about it properly. I distanced myself from dealing with money after London Records had threatened to sue me for millions of pounds. Back then, if I tried to think about those big sums head-on, I felt panicky and short of breath. The only way I felt like I could cope with such a demand was by absenting myself, and pretending it had nothing much to do with me. It wasn't a good way to embark on my financial affairs and try to get to grips with them. I did understand that the record had to make my advance money back before I would receive any royalties, i.e. extra money from further sales, but I didn't realise that the money that they'd spent on sending me to LA to finish the record, for example, plus a million and one other expenses, would also have to be recouped before I received any more money. I'm not saying that's not fair. Of course, the record has to cover all of its own expenses before anyone gets a bonus, but it would have been helpful if someone had explained all this to me. Instead, what my management company did was set me up with an accountant. She, in turn, set me up at a posh bank, and they, in turn, gave me a posh checkbook and bank cards. Me? I wrote a lot of checks. I often wrote checks when using cash would have been easier, but I liked using a checkbook because it added to my view of money as having this abstract, random quality, something I couldn't grasp almost literally. Quite often I wrote checks to dealers when I was buying drugs. I'm not letting myself off the hook for not being more careful or responsible. I should have taken more care, but as soon as I got my accountant, as well as actually assigning and paying her to deal with all my accounts, which is the whole point of an accountant, I also mentally absolved myself of any responsibility in this area, which is not. That was my mistake. It wasn't helped by no one telling me to take more care. Not my manager, not the accountant herself, not the record company, not my family, not the bank manager. There should be an induction course for young people entering the music business, and indeed, why aren't basic money and accountancy skills taught in all schools? Learning how to complete your tax returns and apply for a mortgage would be more useful than algebra, surely. But it's great if you know how to write a hit song, but that doesn't mean you have any business savvy or know how to deal with what may be a sudden, and more often than not short-lived, influx of income. I didn't. I still don't. But I'm learning to get more on top of things and take more care. The first thing I did with my advance was give my mum half of it. I owed it to her for all the parking fines I'd run up over the last few years. I'd spent 10 grand on parking fees. 10 grand. At least. I find it hard to fathom that figure now. But back then, when I was a teenager, I behaved as if parking restrictions or any restrictions didn't apply to me. I got my first car as soon as I was 17. I wasn't disorganised about that. I believed that if I could just get my licence and a car, that would solve everything. I'd be able to drive away from my childhood and into the future. And so as soon as I could, I bought my magic escape vehicle, the maroon Peugeot 206 from Chelmsford car auctions that people used to openly laugh at. Inevitably, I crashed it driving home from the auction, but not badly enough to immobilize it or myself. It just meant that my comedy car looked even more absurd. I parked it everywhere. I was like, who put those two yellow lines there? I don't understand. I was like, that space is just the right size and exactly where I want to be. I'm parking there. I was like, this is my world and my version of reality, and so this is what I'm doing. I was living at my mum's house in Islington when I got the Peugeot, and I'd set my alarm for 7:30 each morning, so that I'd be up in time to inspect the post and scoop up any parking tickets that might have arrived before anyone else saw them. They came most days. I hid them under my bed. The fines began to escalate, and the tickets turned into court orders, and the court orders turned into threats from the bailiffs. All this made me anxious. Like the time I was threatened with being sued, I felt like I was living with a monster under my bed. Whenever I thought about what I knew would be my impending financial doom, my throat would begin to close up and I'd feel I was suffocating. It came to a head when I moved out of my mum's house. Things, as you can imagine, given the way I handled something as simple as parking my car, were getting a bit fraught between mum and me, so I went to live with my godfather, Danny, and his wife, Judy, on Talbot Road in West London. I was organised enough to register the Peugeot to Danny's address, which meant I could get a local parking permit, but I still ran out parking tickets, which I hid under my bed at Danny and Judy's house. It didn't take Danny long to discover them. He phoned my mum to suggest they meet. Look, Danny said to her, I've got a big envelope full of Lily's court orders, parking tickets and bailiff threats, and I'm bringing them to lunch so that you can deal with them. My mum took the envelope. Coming back from the lunch, she stopped to make a work phone call. She sat on a wall by Green Park, engrossed in her telephone conversation. Still talking, she got up and began walking again, and left the package on the wall by accident. But because Danny had recycled an old envelope, it still had his address on the front, and whoever found the package was kind enough to put it in the post. The next day, when Danny sorted through his mail, he discovered that the monstrous envelope he'd just got shot of had been delivered straight back to him. He was like, what is wrong with these people? After the car was impounded, my mum got good at contesting parking tickets, telling various courtrooms that her daughter was depressed and insane. She had no idea that she was describing my future self, but she still had to pay a lot of them. I don't get parking tickets at all anymore. Running up that debt was the last time I took money off my mum. I paid her back, and I've been earning my own money ever since, which is just as it should be. It shouldn't even be notable. It's what adults are expected to do, after all, except that so often I'm accused of being some kind of dilettante. Making music while living off a trust fund, as if my profession is a pastime I've been able to indulge in and got lucky with. I resent that because it's patronising and belittling and not true. When I was working on this book and had nearly finished my fourth album, Mark Ronson invited me on a holiday to stay with him in a villa that he had rented in Ibiza. We've been friends for years and have worked together over the years. He's produced two songs on my last record. Mark had five of his friends staying at the villa too, all guys. They all work in the music industry, and all of them have made more money than me. I don't know if they've worked harder than me, or are more talented, or better at their jobs. I don't think so, necessarily. I think it's straightforward. They are better than me at making money. They are more focused on it, and more successful at it. I watched them on the holiday. They talked about money a lot. They were competitive about it and wound each other up over it. Oh, I thought, this is how the music industry works. It's boys penising off against each other. That's how the deals get higher and higher. It's not the content itself being worth more, it's whoever has the nerve to hoist a figure up the highest and wave their flagpole the hardest. Mark was generous on that Ibiza holiday. He spoiled us. But I began to think more and more. Hang on, shouldn't I be the one inviting people to come away on holiday? And hang on even more, surely if the industry worked the right way and I was a cannier person, shouldn't I own the fucking holiday house? I'd never been able to stash money away or save it well. I did make one wise investment, and that was buying my first flat in Queen's Park. It's the only property I own, and it's where I live now. And though it's not huge for us as a family, it's a big two-bedroom flat. It's great. I bought it once I started making money from All Right Still. I couldn't buy it outright, though. It was expensive, and though I could afford the deposit, I needed a mortgage. That proved difficult because I had bad credit from my history of unpaid parking tickets. I remember thinking, we're fucked in this country. I'm number one in the charts and earning a lot of money, and I'm struggling to get a mortgage, so fuck knows how anyone else is getting onto this housing ladder. The system doesn't work, and there is this whole generation of people wondering how they're going to buy their own home, and that's screwed up. I felt really lucky that I could do it. It's seen me through a lot, that Queen's Park flat. Good times and bad. It was my first home of my own, and a refuge from fame. The whole building is set off from the road, so even when the paparazzi were at their worst, they couldn't come right up close to the flat, because the property had its own small courtyard for the residents to park in. I could get in my car without cameras in my face. It gave me only moments of freedom and privacy, but those moments were crucial. Plus,